Today is Thursday, February 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Joe Biden sends thousands of American troops to Europe amid fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Troop deployment was hinted at by the Pentagon. They had always said that they reserved the right to move troops around within NATO territories should any allies request additional U.S. support.
The U.N. calls on Myanmar to allow delivery of aid to millions of people suffering from conflict.
1 year after the military coup toppled the democratically elected government, UN officials warn the country is moving towards civil war.
And Tonga goes into COVID-19 lockdown as it recovers from devastating volcanic eruption. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The Pentagon says President Joe Biden is sending about 2,000 U.S.-based troops to Poland and Germany and shifting 1,000 soldiers from Germany to Romania. The moves are seen as demonstrations of America's commitment to allies on NATO's eastern flank amid fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia fired back with a sharply worded objection, calling the deployments unfounded and, quote, destructive, unquote. Russian President Vladimir Putin also had a new telephone exchange with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Readouts from both governments showed no progress, with Putin saying the West was giving no ground on Russia's security concerns and Johnson expressing deep concern about Russia's, quote, hostile activity, unquote, on the Ukrainian border. For more, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob.
This troop deployment was hinted at in the past few days by the Pentagon. They had always said that they reserved the right to move troops around within NATO territories should any allies request additional U.S. support. And as Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby made clear, Poland had asked for additional U.S. support. Romania has asked for additional U.S. support. It was also cleared with Germany to bring more troops in. So all of this is being cleared by the alliance because they want to try to coordinate. Even though right now the United States is working alone, it wants to coordinate with the alliance. And you've seen similar moves from France, and you've also seen today NATO applauding this move to try to firm up and better secure its eastern flank, because they are very fearful of what Russia may do in the coming days as it continues to amass troops along Ukraine's borders.
Regardless of how this is framed, analysts are saying it's a serious indication that diplomacy may have failed.
Well, I just spoke with Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. In his interview with VOA, he reiterated that diplomacy is the way the U.S. wants to go on this. And he says that it's still not too late to go with the diplomacy route. But he says, I asked him quite frankly, I said, have you seen Russia show any signs of de-escalation? And he said, no, they have not. All that the United States has seen is an increase of troops, not only on Ukraine's eastern border with Russia, but also along Ukraine's border with Belarus. Now, Russia will tell you that those forces in Belarus right now, those Russian forces in Belarus, they will say that they are simply there for a joint military exercise. And we will have to watch what those troops do in the coming days and how long they plan on staying in Belarus in the coming days. But that's very concerning. Two major NATO allies in particular, Poland, who is right next door, and Lithuania, who is right next door. And they are seeing these troop movements in Belarus, and they are coming back to NATO saying that they are very concerned about what Russia may do.
And if this continues, is it almost a given that U.S. troops might see action?
I don't think that's a given, no. And you had mentioned that report in the País newspaper. I mean, it's very clear the United States wants diplomacy and is willing to offer some back and forth with Russia on things other than what Russia is asking for. Russia wants NATO to say that it will not allow Ukraine to join. And NATO and the U.S. are simply not going to be okay with that, because they say that Ukraine is a sovereign nation and Ukraine should be able to make its own choices. And NATO shouldn't just tell them that they can't join because Russia doesn't want them to join. That's not how the NATO alliance works. And the U.S. and NATO have been very clear on that from the start. Another thing that the U.S. has been very clear about, which goes to your question, is President Biden has said that the U.S. is not going to be fighting Russians in Ukraine. Currently, if you think about the deployments, none of those deployments were to Ukraine. And there are a few U.S. troops in Ukraine right now, but those are part of the Florida National Guard, and they are there on a training mission to train Ukrainian troops that have been fighting with Russian-backed separatists in the east. I was there back in 2015 looking at some of those troops, and it's the same type of training that has been been going on for since 2015. So they're not trying to ramp up their presence in Ukraine. If anything, they've probably got an exit plan. Press Secretary John Kirby has hinted to this, that right now they don't feel that those troops are threatened. But should those troops feel threatened, they would have a way to remove those troops and to potentially remove diplomats as well.
What has been the reaction of some of these countries to this latest U.S. move?
I think that Poland is going to definitely welcome this move. I know that Romania is also going to welcome this move because they requested this additional U.S. support. None of this would have happened unilaterally. The United States would not have imposed additional forces on these countries. It's very clear that they have been concerned from the start on this. And so this is definitely a joint collaboration effort.
That's VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob speaking with me from Washington. With tens of thousands of Russian troops deployed near the Ukrainian border, residents in Kyiv are anxiously watching what Russian leader Vladimir Putin will do next as he continues his campaign to pressure Ukraine and NATO. Many in Kyiv hope war can be avoided, but also fear Putin will decide to launch an invasion. Reporter Oksana Lihostova in Kyiv spoke with residents about their hopes and fears in this story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Twice a week, rain or shine, Alexander Antonets comes here to the Kyiv Hippodrome, where he helps to break in horses. The retired university professor says working with the horses helps him take his mind off the worrying news from the Russia-Ukraine border.
No one can say for sure what Putin is going to do. No one knows really. So we need to be prepared for the worst, for Russia's attack.
Antonets is not afraid of tough times. In 2014, he took part in Euromaidan, a wave of demonstrations to demand closer Ukrainian ties with the EU. Today, he says he's not going to hide or run away. If an invasion does take place, he is prepared to fight.
I know how to handle an F1 grenade. I learned how to do it. There is a police station right under my balcony, so if invaders come, they will occupy it for sure.
Young women who fled the Donbas region and Crimea have already lived through an occupation. They don't treat Putin's threats like a joke. Journalist Alena Maksimenko often travels to eastern Ukraine to gather information for articles and blogs.
I'm not afraid. I was taken prisoner in Crimea in 2014. Then I used to go there as a volunteer on several occasions. I'm not afraid anymore. I think I will go work as a volunteer paramedic. Maybe I'll be able to cover the events as a journalist. I'm ready for however the events unfold.
Recent surveys show more Ukrainians are feeling increasingly negative toward Russia. And as many people prepare for the worst, a poll conducted by Ukrainian think tank Razumkov Center shows that 71% of Ukrainians believe Ukraine is already at war with Russia. For Oksana Lihostova in Kyiv, Anna Rice, VOA News.
The United Nations is calling on Myanmar's military authority to allow unimpeded delivery of life-saving humanitarian aid to millions of people suffering from conflict, poverty, acute hunger, and ill health. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Conflict and insecurity are raging in many parts of Myanmar. 1 year after the military coup toppled the democratically elected government, UN officials warn the country is moving towards civil war. The United Nations reports the growing crisis has plunged an estimated 14.4 million people into destitution. In response to this deteriorating situation, the UN has appealed for a record $826 million to provide relief for 6.2 million people. Jens Laerke is spokesman for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He says the economic and political turmoil sparked by last year's coup, combined with the devastating impact of COVID-19, have driven half of Myanmar's 25 million population into poverty.
Many can no longer afford to feed their families because of job and income losses and price increases. Over 13 million people are moderately or severely food insecure, and malnutrition is expected to worsen among children unless we support the parents to provide enough nutritious food for their kids.
The UN reports more than 400,000 people have been displaced since the military takeover. It says thousands are living in appalling conditions, while many others have fled to Thailand and India in search of refuge. Lierke acknowledges the UN is asking for a lot of money to support its humanitarian operation in Myanmar without any guarantee it will be able to reach those in need. He explains the appeal is based on need and not on the ability to deliver aid.
It goes without saying that the relationship with the authorities are not particularly rosy. We hear that from everybody. We are particularly trying to deliver aid in urban areas, which is kind of a new caseload in this crisis, the urban population and the urban needs of particular concern.
The UN Human Rights Office has documented 1,500 civilian deaths since last year's coup. It reports people were killed during street protests or when security forces raided homes or villages in search of opponents. It adds that approximately 200 people have been killed due to torture while in military custody. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visits Ukraine Thursday to mediate between Kyiv and Moscow amid rising tensions. Despite having close ties with both Ukraine and Russian presidents, analysts warn Erdogan faces a challenge on several fronts. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan hopes to defuse tensions as Russia continues its military build-up near the Ukrainian border. Asla Aydin-Tashbash, a senior fellow at the European Council, says Erdogan believes he's uniquely positioned to mediate.
Turkey desperately wants to be the intermediary in this conflict. Erdogan wanting to use his relationship with Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, the fact Turkey's a NATO country, and Erdogan, Turkish president, really gets along with Putin. So he's been offering to negotiate.
The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has welcomed Erdogan's mediation efforts. But international relations professor Mustafa Aydin of Istanbul's Kadir Has University warns the Turkish leader is facing a tough challenge.
Turkey is in a good place, actually, to mediate. My pessimism comes from the Russian perspectives. I don't think that Russia is looking for a mediation between itself and Ukraine. They are looking for a mediation talk to the United States on the top level rather than Ukraine.
Putin's vague acceptance of Erdogan's offer last month to visit Turkey, saying he would only visit when the COVID epidemic permits, is seen by some analysts as an indication of Russia's reluctance for any Turkish mediation role. Petra Bukovsky, a senior fellow at the Democratic Initiatives Foundation in Kiev, says Ukraine is aware of Turkey's limitations as a mediator, but says Zelensky could be looking to Erdogan as a facilitator.
I don't think Turkey can bring a lot to the table of negotiations. However, if Erdogan succeeds to arrange a personal meeting between Zelensky and Putin, Zelensky can use this opportunity domestically. If these talks are successful or productive, then it's really good for both Zelensky and for country. And if they are unsuccessful, he can also say that we've exhausted all possible variants and now we have to do something else.
Ankara strongly opposes Russia's occupation of Crimea and has been supportive of Kiev in its tense relationship with Moscow. Turkey is also selling armed drones to Ukraine in defiance of protests from Moscow. Turkish companies are leading investors to Ukraine, and Erdogan is expected to sign a free trade agreement during his visit. Analyst Aydin Tashbash says such a stance will play well with Turkey's Western partners.
Ankara is seeing this as an opportunity to improve relations with NATO, relations with Washington. They've been really up and down and sometimes quite tense over the last few years. So the Ukraine crisis is a chance to polish Turkey's credentials as a NATO member.
But in the sign of the balancing act Turkey's performing, Ankara made a gesture to Moscow Monday, reiterating its commitment to the Montreux Convention, which restricts warships' access to the Black Sea, including those of NATO. With Turkey dependent on Russian gas and cooperation in Syria, analysts warn that Erdogan is aware Moscow can extract a heavy price on Turkey. Dorian Jones to VOA News, Istanbul.
Guinea-Bissau's President Umaro Sissoko Embalo has said an attempted coup on Tuesday may have been linked to drug trafficking. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Heavy gunfire had sounded near a government compound where Umaro Sissoko Embalo had been chairing a cabinet meeting.
When I was elected president of the republic, I promised to fight two things, corruption and drug trafficking. And this is also linked to that. And I knew what the prize was, but the fight continues.
Guinea-Bissau is known as a major transit point for Latin American cocaine headed for Europe. That has contributed to the West African country's instability. It's seen 10 coups or attempted coups since independence from Portugal in 1974. Only one democratically elected president has completed a full term. Embalo said it was not a failed coup, but an assassination attempt. State radio said on Wednesday that at least six people had been killed, two members of the presidential guard and four assailants.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. UN agencies in Malawi have started providing aid to victims from Tropical Storm Anna, which killed scores of people across southeastern Africa and left tens of thousands homeless. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, has provided personal hygiene and water treatment kits to approximately 15,000 people. But Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera says more assistance is needed, as Lamek Masina reports from Chikwawa, Malawi.
The latest report from Malawi's Department of Disaster Management says the floods killed 33 people, displaced more than 100,000, and affected nearly 200,000 households in the country. The storm also damaged at least 19 health facilities, destroying medicines and cold chain equipment. Muhammad Faure is UNICEF's regional director for East and Southern Africa. He is in Malawi visiting flood-hit areas.
For the moment, our focus, of course, is on life-saving commodities, namely those that help for water, those help for sanitation, non-food item. Probably also some tent, latrines, cleaning stuff also, because I'm sure that with the water level dropping, resettlement will be a challenge.
Four notes that the destruction of water and sanitation facilities puts children and their families at risk of waterborne diseases such as cholera. Meanwhile, the World Food Programme announced Wednesday that it has set aside an initial amount of $500,000 for relief assistance to the flood victims. Paul Tanibu is the WFP country director in Malawi.
As part of our immediate response, WFP is providing corn soya blend to some 21,000 households, around 95,000 people, in the four most affected districts of Chikwawa, Mulanje, Nsanje, and Palombe. Distribution started yesterday, the 1st of February.
Tanibu added the WFP is currently prioritizing displaced people living in temporary shelters as it looks for additional resources to scale up its response. The head of the Department of Disaster Management, Charles Kalemba, told a press conference Tuesday that the relief efforts are hampered by lack of funding despite several government appeals for financial assistance. During his tour to affected areas Tuesday, President Lazarus Chakwera called for more assistance to help thousands of Malawians affected by floods in over half of the country's 28 districts. Chakwera says as we continue asking for more assistance from our partners, we should also make sure that in our national budget this year, we should allocate some to help rebuild public infrastructures destroyed by the storm. Tropical Storm Anna also killed at least 20 people in Mozambique and 48 people in Madagascar. The Malawian president said he will soon meet with African Union heads of state to ask for support in aiding areas affected by the storm. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Chikwawa, Malawi.
In other news, CNN President Jeff Zucker has abruptly resigned after acknowledging a consensual relationship with another network executive. The entanglement came to light during an investigation of now-fired anchor Chris Cuomo. Zucker said Wednesday that he was required to disclose the relationship when it began, but he did not. The Cuomo investigation revealed that a former anchor had aided his brother, then New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, as he navigated a sexual harassment scandal. The CEO of Warner Media told employees that an interim leadership plan would be announced shortly. Zucker, who is 56, has been an industry leader since he was executive producer of the quote Today Unquote show in the 1990s. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the Taliban for information about the whereabouts of six women who were abducted 2 weeks ago in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The agency says it is extremely concerned about the fate of the six who were abducted in connection with women's rights protests in Kabul. On Saturday, the de facto Taliban authorities announced they were investigating the disappearance of these individuals. Human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says no confirmed information on their whereabouts has been received.
We call on the de facto authorities to publicly report on the findings of their investigation into the abduction and disappearance of these women and their relatives, and to take all possible measures to ensure their safe and immediate release, and to hold those responsible to account.
Shamdasani says since the women were abducted, there have been worrying reports about searches at the homes of other women who have taken part in demonstrations. She says information about where they have been taken and their well-being is lacking and unclear. All of this, she says, perpetuates a climate of fear and uncertainty.
These reports have also brought into focus what appears to be a pattern of arbitrary arrests and detentions, as well as torture and ill treatment of civil society activists, journalists, and media workers, and former government officials and security forces in Afghanistan. We also continue to receive credible allegations of other gross human rights violations.
Shamdasani says control over dissent appears to be tightening. Taliban government spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid bristles at criticism such as this. In response to media questions earlier in the week on the disappearance of the six women, he denied that any were being held. Then he said the authorities had the right, quote, to arrest and detain dissidents or those who break the law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Tonga went into COVID-19 lockdown Wednesday as it recovers from last month's devastating volcanic eruption and tsunami waves. The Pacific archipelago has reported 2 cases of coronavirus after previously recording just a single infection last October. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
2 dock workers handling humanitarian aid in Tonga have tested positive for COVID-19. The international relief effort is like no other as Tonga recovers from one disaster while trying to avoid another. It has strict no-contact protocols that act as a barrier to prevent transmission of the new coronavirus from foreign navy ships and aircraft to the Tongan people. But those defences appear to have been breached, and the Pacific archipelago will go into lockdown for at least 2 days starting Wednesday. Australia's Navy vessel HMAS Adelaide unloaded supplies last week despite a coronavirus outbreak that infected more than 20 of its crew. Britain, France, New Zealand and the United States have also been delivering essential supplies. Tongan journalist Marion Kupu told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that 2 infected port staff had worked closely with aid shipments.
We're talking about people who are there on first hand when we have ships or aircraft coming into Tonga, offloading cargoes, and also they're the front line. These are the first person, first contact with anything landing here in Tonga. We just need to protect their identity while they work on trying to find or to trace where they've been in the past few days.
Tonga has a population of just over 100,000. It closed its borders in early 2020 as the coronavirus pandemic swept the globe. Since then, the island nation has diagnosed just one case of COVID-19 in a man who returned from New Zealand in October last year and has since fully recovered. The volcanic blast, 65 kilometres north of the Tongan capital of Nuku'alofa, was one of the biggest recorded in decades, generating massive tsunami waves and blanketing the island nation in toxic ash. 3 people died. The United Nations said last week that drinking water remained the main challenge facing Tonga. An undersea communications cable that connects the archipelago to the rest of the world was damaged in the volcanic eruption. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The 2022 Beijing Olympics kicks off on Friday, but even before the opening ceremony, these games face some hurdles. VOA's Penelope Poulou has more.
The International Olympic Committee has the honor to announce the host city of the Olympic Winter Games 2022. Beijing.
91 nations participate in the Beijing Olympics with a total of 109 events across 15 sports. In Beijing, Olympic officials have imposed strict protocols to prevent the spread of COVID. Tickets will not be sold to the public. Beijing has announced a closed-loop system where athletes and others involved in the Olympics will work, compete, eat and sleep without coming into contact with the general public. All vaccinated participants can move freely in games-related areas by a dedicated transport system. Unvaccinated athletes will have to spend 21 days in quarantine ahead of the games. Domestic and international participants will be tested daily. But COVID-19 is not the only hurdle for the Beijing Olympics. According to the Washington Post, a coalition of international activists has pressed for a boycott of what they are calling the #2022 Genocide Olympics, citing China's treatment of Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities in China's northern province of Xinjiang. According to China's state-owned broadcaster, CCTV, Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Wang Wenbin criticized the politicization of the Beijing Olympics. Despite the global outcry against Beijing's human rights abuses, neither the Apolitical International Olympic Committee nor NBCU, the Olympics' exclusive broadcaster in the U.S., will take a stand against Beijing, says Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College.
They all have massive investments in these games, and they want them to come off well. They need to cooperate with each other.
Zimbalist, who has published several books on the economics of the Olympic Games, points out that China wields great influence on international markets, which do not want to ruffle Beijing's feathers.
On the one hand, you have markets like the United States, where people want you to be uttering phrases and following policies that are congruent with human values. On the other hand, you've got a country that's violating those values. But it's, you know, you're selling $15 billion of goods to them every year, or you actually have an investment as a partner in some of their activities. And so how do you steer a course in between those two things? It's delicate.
According to Variety.com, NBCU is facing a huge challenge on attracting eyeballs to the event, not only because of China's human rights violations, but also because 6 months after the Summer Olympics in Tokyo, spectators are going through what it calls Olympic Games fatigue. However, Zimbalist says most viewers do not bring a political mindset to the questions of whether they are going to follow the Olympic Games. They do it, he says, for the thrill of the games, the competition, and the teams they root for. Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Washington.
Hi, this is Rick Pantaleo inviting you to join my guests and me for part 2 of our program on near-Earth objects and planetary defense on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. We'll talk about the work of NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office, and we'll discuss the mission of NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART. Listen Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition and the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinenuofo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, ba-ba-bo-zip.